I think we're a nation in a serious economic crisis, for example, where there is very little, I mean, not only is the government relatively indifferent, it seems to me, to the larger, I mean, not just the immediacy of the crisis, but the long-run aspects of it, the fact that this is not some temporary little cyclical thing, but an historic moment. But the main instrument of communications is doing a thoroughly inadequate job, because it's just, in particular, particularly a kind of story that it feels uncomfortable with. It isn't the story that anybody much likes. And if it does it well, it may bring low ratings. I don't see anything for the moment reversing it. I think it's a very dangerous subject. I think that we are, as I say, trivializing the process. I think it's most of the signs now are worse than they were 10 years ago. I happen to think the people are good, the net result is bad. I think most of it, or much of it, is out of the half hour, and the particular importance of film and the inability to check it, and I don't see it. I mean, I think when Kuralt is dumped for Curtis, that's getting not just into local, but that's into the network sector. So I'm feeling very nervous, because I think it has a profound impact upon who we are. Let me give you, I mean, I'm going to give you an example of how I think it affects the society in a negative way. And it's a personal one, because I write books and therefore I check out bestseller lists. If you read the New York Times bestseller list, nonfiction bestseller list these days, it is really a buffoon's list. I mean, with the exception of a book, say, by my colleague Russell Baker, which is a very lovely memoir of growing up in the Depression, it is mostly three or four books by Jane Fonda about exercise, having babies, whatever, how to get on with a radical after the radical period is over, whatever. It has a number of Andy Rooney books. Andy Rooney is funny again. It has two or three diet books. It has Weight Watcher books. This, I mean, it is a list of fantasy books. And they are all books that are, it seems to me, an almost absolute reflection of morning and afternoon television shows, of who gets on. I mean, and so a publishing house torn between signing up a particular writer who may have a good book, but maybe not a great popular possibility, and hearing that Shelley Winters is about to write her memoirs, knows that even though Shelley may not be a great writer and her memoirs may not be the sort of things upon which history turns, knows that Shelley will, if she goes on the tour, will be able to get on every single local television station in America, and therefore the book will sell 150,000 copies in hardcover, that it will make the bestsellers, and therefore they will put their money and their energy into that and not into whatever serious book. And I have seen that list change, I think, quite dramatically over 10 years, and I think it's very much out of what goes on in the television show. Who gets on? I mean, the Richard Simmons How to Dance Around the Room book or whatever. I mean, and that may be who we are becoming, and it's not a happy thought. I mean, it's not anything that's really a lot of fun. And it happens to, I'm annoyed and I'm scared because it's in my particular profession. But I'm scared for us as a culture, because there was a time 10 years ago when it was easier to get a serious writer of a serious book on some of these shows. And now, you know, they see this, and it's easier now to get an actress's memoirs or somebody's diet book or how to take care of your cat book on. And it is a fantasy world. And we're not living in a fantasy world. We're living, I mean, the era when America could be rich and careless is over. I mean, that era ended in 1979, when we were so rich and everyone else was poor that we could be afford to be flagrantly wasteful. Now we are, involuntarily or not, we are going to share the pie with other nations. And whether we can understand that well enough even to compete is a question that hangs before us. The first positive thing about it is that it breaks the formula of networkies, of a minute 30, of, you know, someone just doing almost this sort of tiny little brief report. So there is at least the longer thing there. I don't know that anybody needs 24 hours of news, by the way. That seems to me a serious saturation, oversaturation. I mean, I think the mind would explode on about the 18th hour. But I think getting outside the formula is positive. And there are moments on the Ted Turner network where, in fact, they're very good. I mean, when they get the right reporter on the scene, my old colleague from Vietnam, Peter Arnett, when a good reporter is on the story, then they're just terrific. The problem is this for, say, Ted Turner. One, it is very hard to start up a news operation. It is an odd thing. It demands tradition. The University of Pennsylvania is what it is, and a great, I mean, you would not lightly open a new university tomorrow. It'd be very hard next door, no matter how much money you had, it would be hard to rival this. And that is because there is a tradition here, and that tradition has brought a certain kind of faculty, and that has also brought a certain kind of student. And that is true of news organizations. You know, the New York Times draws a certain kind of reporter because traditionally it has accepted a high intelligence and given freedom to those reporters, and therefore the best of a generation have wanted to work there. CBS, for example, has always been stronger than the other networks because Ed Murrow was there, and because Ed Murrow was there, Schoenbrunn and Smith and Severide came, and because that generation came, you know, Roger Mudd and Dan Rather and Bruce Morton and Fred Graham and another generation came. So, I mean, it is something that generates itself and keeps going on. That's going to be a problem for Turner. You cannot come flying out of the box and just overnight invent a tradition. It is something that has to beget itself. The second thing about it is you come to, I mean, certainly Turner is very smart. And he did the hookup with the satellite very well. The question, though, is what is Ted Turner's value system? And that is a very troubling thing for a lot of people who work there. Has he got the true tolerance of journalism to allow his journalists to do distinguished things, even though, in fact, they go against the things that he holds true, which is what you really need? I mean, a great publisher is someone who allows people to write things that annoy him enormously. I mean, and in fact, go against his sensibilities, since most publishers and owners of networks are in fact rich, and since most journalists are in fact in touch with those who are poor, there's an ongoing struggle. Will Turner have this kind of great tolerance and belief in the democratic process that it will right itself? I would doubt it. Most of what I know is, in fact, he possibly is ambitious himself, that he is intolerant of blacks, intolerant of Jews. He once told a friend of mine who had resigned in protest of something, he said, "Listen, do you know what you're doing? You're leaving CNN, and that's the only thing that stands between godless communism and this country." I mean, so a man who has that kind, I don't look for a rich journalistic tradition to flower from that kind of sensibility. Now, the one thing that cable, on another note, may do for the news organizations is this, and this is really, I'm not a great futurist and nobody really knows what will happen, but if we are in an age of cable and there's going to be one sport channel, two sports channels, and if we are going to see HBO doing almost its own entertainment, and if you're going to have channels doing movies and whatever, then the competition for the networks is going to be very stiff in fact, entertainment. And the one area that they may find themselves stronger and able to compete in, because it's expensive to do news and they have a tradition and they have talent, is they may involuntarily find that the sinews of their operation are their news departments. And that may make them stronger within the organization than they are now. That if it's just pure entertainment against entertainment, then HBO can come in tomorrow and do better stuff than some of their sitcoms. But it's damn hard to come in tomorrow and do a better news program than the Evening News or the Kuralt Show or whatever. I think, first off, there were gradations of turning on the war in Vietnam. I mean, and I do not want to come to you tonight and imply that there was, when I was 29 years old, standing in Dinh Thuong province, an epiphany that made me lead the Dove Brigade, because I think we all went through a number of steps in the odyssey towards dovishness and turning on the war. The first thing was, it didn't work. There's a wonderful story about my predecessor, who was there for a couple months, a great reporter named Homer Biggert, and he had gone down to Mito in this area in the Delta, and he'd gone down with my young colleague, friend, then from UPI, Neil Sheehan. And they'd gone down, and there was the American helicopters had just arrived, and there was supposed to be 3 days of battles and 3 days of famous victories. And they went out the first day, and there was a sort of victory of sorts. And the second day, they went out with helicopters, and it was a pillow-punching operation designed to let the Viet Cong escape. And the third day, another one of these fake things, you know, designed to let the VC escape. And on the way back that day, driving back to Saigon, Neil was sort of muttering and complaining, and Homer Biggert, then in his 50s, a great, great journalist, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner, said, Mr. Sheehan, what's the matter? And Neil muttered, grumbled, and said, about 3 days wasted, no story. And Homer said, ah, Mr. Sheehan, oh, there is a story. It doesn't work, Mr. Sheehan. That's your story. And I think that this is what we all went through. I mean, we were out there. We would began by being sympathetic to the American cause and what we were trying to do, and we went out in the field, and everywhere we went, we found that that which was supposed to be happening wasn't happening. The war wasn't being won. Indeed, it wasn't being fought. And we gradually, that, you know, if it wasn't being fought and won, why not? And that took us to one question, and finally, gradually, to dovishness. And I think most of us, by late 64, there was a sense on the part of, say, Neil and me, that the roots of that, why wasn't it won, why didn't it work, were in the Indochina War, the French Indochina War, that what the Americans, in Bernard Fall's phrase, were walking in the same footsteps as the French, although dreaming different dreams. And that, you know, that those people that we called the generals, the Saigon generals, Vietnamese, were in fact former French corporals, and that all the people who had been fighting the War of Liberation were on the other side. They had liberated their country in the colonial war, and they had all the dynamism and all the nationalism, and everything that had happened from that flowed from that one moment. And you just saw that. I mean, you went out and you just again and again saw that that which we were doing was a lie, and that the officers in the field, the colonels, the captains, would just take you aside. I mean, when you'd go down the first day, they'd be very cautious with you and say, oh, yeah, it's working out pretty well. And then you would go out on an operation with them. And if you've gone out on an operation with someone, he's just not going to lie to you the next day. I mean, you're not going to risk your life with another man, and then he's going to come back at dinner and lie to you. I mean, there's just too much humanity and integrity involved in the sharing of that experience. And with that, we began to have very good sources. And the people who normally were reporting to Saigon and saying it doesn't work began to report to us instead. I mean, told us what they, since Saigon wouldn't listen, they told us. As someone said, Saigon's not opening its mail, so you might as well hear it from me, because I'm not going to take this goddamn risk for no one hearing it. On the best and the brightest, I started the book in 69. It was clear to me that was post-Tet. It was clear to me that the war was a disaster. It had torn the country apart. And it looked to me, I mean, I thought, you know, how could this have happened? I mean, you know, you remembered the early euphoria of the Kennedy administration, this allegedly brilliant group of people had come to office. And how was it ending in this great tragedy, maybe the great tragedy since the Civil War? And I just decided I would take 3 years, 4 years of my life and set out to find out that if I went out and interviewed two people a day for 2 or 3 years, I'd find out. And I mean, I would make it interesting. I'd find out what had happened and who were they and what had happened and why. And I went at it like an infantryman. It burned in my stomach. I was passionate about what had happened and what went wrong. I was probably from the same class in a way as were the architects of the war. I mean, the children of Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Pennsylvania did not fight the war, but the graduates of those schools and sometimes the professors and indeed the deans were the academics of it. So I had probably a particular passion on that subject, and I went out and did it. And I just stayed with it. I just said, okay, I've got nothing else to do for 3 years. I mean, nothing else I need be. I'll check back in about 3 or 4 years. And it was an act of witness. And I'm very glad I did it. I've never had any regrets about it. Someone asked me later if I did it today, whether I would be as tough. And I said, probably tougher. I mean, you know, I mean, I think it hasn't gone away, really. Well, your question is very well put, and it's a very thoughtful question, and I think I dissent from it. I think you're right. I think they give all of them, the one thing they do which is positive is they give all of America a good page one. And lots of people who, in fact, in the good old days didn't get a good page one, who live up in Montana, Idaho, or Arizona, are able to get, used to get, suddenly could get the Huntley Brinkley Show or Cronkite. And it brought some level of connection in that had never been there before, because the papers that had served them were often so bad. My objection is this. First off, I don't accept the idea that the people in West Philadelphia, I mean, I think there's a difference between the New York Times' 1 million constituency for the whole country and the 70 or 80 million who watch the evening news. I think news, there's a median point. And I don't accept the idea, in fact, that the people in West Philadelphia or wherever it is, or here or there, are not educable. One of the founding geniuses of television was a man named Pat Weaver, and he invented the Today Show, and he invented the Tonight Show, and he had a wonderful vision of television, and he really, more than most people, helped bring it out, which was to turn the common man, his phrase was, into the uncommon man. And I believe that is possible. I believe that you can. I mean, I think I look at the Sunday morning show with Charles Carroll, which is by far the best thing on television. I don't know if any of you watch it, but if you can, you should try and make it a part of your habit. I mean, there is a sense of intelligence, of literacy, of sophistication in the best way. I mean, it is enhancing of the world around us, and it's done very easily and richly. And I can't but believe that if there were something like that done regularly in the second half hour of an hourly news show, that a fair percentage of people wouldn't stay with it, and in the process become better citizens. And as there was better coverage, for example, of the political process, the politicians would begin to behave better. One of the things that it seems to me works against our political system being better than it is the sense that these men and women don't get on television, and therefore there's no real need for them to behave well. I thought, for example, at the time of the impeachment of Richard Nixon, I remember what everybody said, you know, God, put the House of Representatives on television, they're all idiots and they'll embarrass themselves. But because we were watching, they behave better, and because they behave better, we behave better. And in fact, it was exactly the kind of America that the founding fathers, who could not have conceived of television, would have been in fact very proud of. I mean, that we all enhanced each other. And if you could begin to ventilate some issues with some real, instead of just reporters in a minute 30 telling you about salt or the nuclear freeze in sort of half-code buzzwords that don't explain, but allowing a real reporter and putting on some senators to do it, I think people would feel they could understand it more. I think that that's the skill. The skill of a great journalist is to allow ordinary people to understand what are seemingly complicated things. I mean, it can be done. It takes skill. It takes skill in defining and balancing, but it can be done. And I have a kind of confidence that if it's done, people will know it. Will some of them, not all of them, some will stay on. Some will, I mean, I think history, which is the day's events, I think it's exciting. I don't think it's boring. And I think the byplay of the forces in our lives, and 60 Minutes, a show I don't much like that much anymore, is a reflection that, in fact, these things can be made to be interesting and to draw an audience. And I would believe that we've got to do this, that if we don't, in fact, we cut our citizens off from our political process. And I know what you're saying, but I think there's a median line. I mean, I remember, you know, if you have an evening show of 25 million, and it drops in the second half hour to 10 million, 10 million people is a lot of people. It has a profound effect. I remember when I did a chunk on Bill Paley in the Atlantic Monthly, from the book I was working on. The Atlantic Monthly has a circulation of 300,000. They were so irate, so crazed at CBS, that's all they really sort of thought of there for a while, that they seriously thought of buying the Atlantic Monthly so that something like this, an outrage like this, would never happen again. The point of this is, I think you can reach a lot of... The television's great mistake has, in fact, always been to go to super numbers and not to do more about just doing the right thing, and if you do the right thing, it will be influential, and that's more important than even the sheer totality of numbers. First off, I am enormously disrespectful of the Gannett chain. I don't think it's a good chain. You happen to have, most chain newspapers, I've been hard on television, so I should say that I think most chain newspapers in America are really quite bad. There's very little sense of real caring about what the newspaper itself is and what its relationship to a community is, and instead it's an attempt to almost collect newspapers like postage stamps and to maximize the profit. And I think it's a very unfortunate trend, and Gannett has been almost the worst offender. You know, drive the stock up, maximize profit, and almost, I think, leaving the thinnest kind of newspaper behind. And that a chain like this, which is so, I think, indifferent in community after community to any kind of journalistic excellence, that they would really have the chutzpah to sort of put out a national daily, it almost boggles the mind. And what I've seen of it, the front parts of the paper are about what I expect, thin and shallow and not very good. And oddly enough, in the two times I saw it, the back part, the cultural section, books and whatever, was surprisingly good. So it's not, I mean, it's mostly what I thought it was, with one little surprising part. Well, you're right, he really was wonderful in Latin America, and El Salvador, Ray Bonner was just enormously distinguished, tough-minded, again and again would report, and they would condemn his reporting, and then he would turn out to be right. What's ironic now is that the American ambassador down there, Hinton, is beginning to sound like Bonner in being critical of the Salvadorian government. What happened, I think it was, I had wished he had not been brought back. I think he was not happy to. Ray is a kind of interesting experiment with the Times. He really had a lot of experience in Latin America and a lot of ability, and he had never really been a working journalist before. And he went down there and I think did well. He came under enormous criticism from vested interests in the State Department, people down there, from the administration, because he was again and again jarring the sensibility. Those who would say, well, we're really okay, the government's okay, it's changing regularly, it's coming around, and we're going to, we'll be all right. And Ray kept saying, in effect, the government isn't listening to us, and it is a very harsh government, and that which we are, in effect, in danger of being sucked into another Vietnam. I think the Times was uneasy with that kind of pressure. It always is. It's not a lot of fun. And in particular, I think it was bothered because this was a man, in effect, who had never been a journalist before. And I think finally, you know, they put him down there for 3 months, then they extended him for another 3 or 4 months, and then finally, I think they thought, well, gee, maybe we should have him back here in New York and see if he can really report on other things. And they brought him back. I wish they hadn't. I think he wishes they hadn't. But I think sometimes that's the way it goes. But I think there is this, and that is, as my reporting in Vietnam, with whatever flaws it had, in effect, I think set some kind of tone. And that is, if the story is there and it really isn't going well, whether your country likes it or not, you write it. As I did that in Saigon, and I think made it easier in some ways for my successors to come along, I think what Ray Bonner has done in El Salvador is already reflected in his successors, and I think it will, I mean, I think he has set the norm for the Times, and I would be surprised that if the Times is reporting backs down from that. I think that he has in fact set a kind of prototype that it's there, and unless the government changes dramatically, which it's not likely to do, that you keep reporting it. But you're absolutely right in singling out how excellent he was, and I wish he were still there. Well, I think that people will always choose to be, I mean, otherwise, given no particular alternative, people will choose to be entertained rather than to have to think. And the line between a great editor in print is someone who's able to, the definition of a great editor, is someone who is able to draw the line between what people want to know and what they need to know. And that's always been a great delicate thing. And that is the responsibility, it seems to me, of the networks is to be able to draw that same line. And my point is that, I mean, obviously, in the society as a whole, there will be all things being equal. If you don't give people anything better, they will choose what you give them. I mean, people will drive out of Detroit big cars as long as you give them big cars and give them bad small cars, which is what Detroit did. And then one day Detroit looked around and they had deserted. It seems to me, enormously unfair of the networks not to give people any kind of alternative possibility and then say, well, this is the only thing they want. A, their obligation is they have this particular charter. I mean, the founding, it wasn't that Mr. Paley was one of the early settlers and decided to buy this company. I mean, they have a special charter of freedom of speech, and it's the public's airways. And they are very quick whenever there is any kind of issue to send down battalions of lawyers and spokesmen and people to write speeches demanding First Amendment privilege. And they are. And Godspeed, let them have the First Amendment privilege. I mean, if you kept them out of the House impeachment hearings, they would have been there, any other kind of hearings, they'd give you speeches and lawyers. The trouble is that by and large, except when it's, say, it's something like the impeachment proceedings, they don't cover it. They demand the right to do it and do not exercise those freedoms. What I'm saying is simply that given the enormous affluence, I mean, we're not talking about people who are about to go broke. It's not the Philadelphia Bulletin. We're talking about people making profit upon profit upon profit. I'm just saying, given the immense freedom and privilege they have, they owe us more. And it isn't a judgment on the American people, it's a judgment on them. I mean, if they give us something better, I think some people will stay with it. And they give it to us at a decent hour. And I mean, not everybody, but it is. I mean, you know, the idea that you have to have this maximum circulation and the ratings, I mean, that you can't, I mean, if you put 10 million, you know, if 10 million people watch a particular program that's germane to the public interest, that's a great victory. And they have decided in their particular way of doing the ratings that that is a defeat. And that's not acceptable. That is a reflection of immense greed. We in America constantly make fun of the communists, as well we should, for their perversion of information. What we are not accepting in our own society, and something we really have to do more about, is the fact that in our prime carrier, and the communist society, the state does dominate. I mean, Polish television is as written by Jaruzelski. I mean, it is theirs. It is all the cliches about communism are true. What we have got to come to terms with is the degree to which now our prime carrier in this society is formed by commercial greed. Well, it's hard to remove the competitive aspect. I mean, we are competitive, and one of the best things about our profession is our competitiveness. And in fact, one of the things that's melancholy about what's happening in print is the fact that it's a monopoly. It's not a healthy thing for a newspaper. It's not a healthy thing for a community. It's very unhealthy for Washington, D.C. that there's really one paper. I mean, inevitably, you're going to have an arrogance of power. I mean, you're going to have in New York or Boston or Philadelphia or L.A. where there is really only one paper, that leads, it seems to me, to inevitable, no matter how well-intentioned the people, monopoly and thus arrogance of power, or at least decisions, however humbly made, though I doubt that, but are perceived to be arrogant. So the competition, it seems to me, is a good thing. What bothers me is the absolute sense of the unwillingness of the networks to, in fact, pay their dues and come to terms. And now the networks claim that they, in fact, would like to do it, but it's the affiliate stations that won't permit them. In truth, they could come on from, say, 7:30 to 8:30 or from 8 to 9. I mean, there are all kinds of things they could do. What I'm saying about the need for an hour news show, and I don't think you'll get rid of the competition. I think it's germane, and I think it's actually healthy. But one thing I want to leave you with, and there's nothing I've said tonight in talking to you about the need for an hour news show, is anything different than what Dan Rather or Roger Mudd or Dick Saland or anybody there who really works honorably in that particular vineyard would tell you about the desperate need for it. I mean, Dick Saland once told me, the former head of CBS News, that the worst thing he ever allowed was Walter Cronkite to go on the air every night and say at the end of the show, and that's the way it is, because it's not the way it is. It's a very small part of the way it is. And these people know it. They have fought within their own corporations for the hour. They don't get it. And I think it's very important to sort of keep on their tail and to be aware, in the meantime, that there is a profound... What I told you when I gave that long description of Iran, and on the one hand, and on the other, the inability to, or the unwillingness to cover something complicated like the change in the core economy, that seems to me a very important thing to take away, because it is a reflection of how a medium, not out of perniciousness or venom or evil or whatever, how out of the norms of its own institution, which demands film, how it creates a reality that is in fact not reality. And it's an almost classic example. The one which is made large but is unimportant, and the other, because they don't have the film, is made small, and it is desperately important. Thank you all very much.